You're listening to Otto D. coming at you live.
Wait, what, when, how? Mr. Otto D. flip the track right now.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for tuning in on this gorgeous Monday evening where my guest is dancing in the chair to my opening music, and that's a first for me, which was fun. I am your host, Otto Daniolo, broadcasting at the Star Worldwide Network Studios high above Camelback Road, where tonight my guest is a man who pioneered radio as a station owner and booked some of the biggest names as a premier concert promoter and has done so much more. I was referred to in a particular book I read recently as the jack of all trades and the master of many. Mr. Ray Odom will be with us right after this first song, which I'm hoping that puts another smile on his face. It's an old tune called For the Good Times from Ray Price.
Don't look so sad. I know it's over, but life goes on, and this old world will keep on turning. Let's just be glad we had some time to spend together. There's no need to watch the bridges that we're burning. Lay your head upon my pillow. Hold your warm and tender body close to mine. Hear the whisper of the raindrops blowing soft against the window, and make believe you love me one more time. For the good times, I'll get along. You'll find another, and I'll be here if you should find you ever need me. Don't say a word about tomorrow or forever. There'll be time enough for sadness when you leave me. Lay your upon my pillow, hold your warm and tender body close to mine. Hear the whisper of the raindrops blowing soft against the window, and make believe you love me one more time. For the good time,
listening to Otto D. coming at you live.
And that was For the Good Times by Ray Price here on the Otto D. Show, which is brought to you by TheRecordingArtist.com. If you happen to have your own recording setup at home, you may realize that sometimes a little professional help can go a long way to making that new special song sound a little more pro. So when you need a little help, visit therecordingartist.com and check out what they can do for you. And now, without further ado, it is my pleasure to welcome Arizona Music and Entertainment Hall of Fame inductee and the one and only Mr. Ray Odom. Ray, how are you doing?
Otto, I'm great. And hey, you do a tremendous job here, and you're to be congratulated for doing what you're doing.
Well, gosh, thank you. But it always makes me feel funny when I'm sitting at this side of the table with a guy like you on that side of the table who's, you know, done so much in radio. So it's going to be exciting for me to have an opportunity to talk to you.
Well, thank you. It's my pleasure. I'm delighted.
Well, I'm glad you came in. And, you know, your career spans decades in radio and the entertainment business, and it's crossed paths with so many of the greats of our time. I know we're going to get just a ton of cool stories, and I'm really excited about it. But I want to kind of start with going all the way back to Abilene, Texas, where you were from, because you were born in
1926. I'm 100 years old.
A little earlier than me. And I can't imagine what Abilene, Texas was like then.
I was actually from Coleman. I was on a farm.
Let's pretend you were from Abilene.
Okay, Abilene. But it was just 30 miles up the road,
oh, okay.
You see.
All right.
And so I got a call one day. I was on the Coleman station, and I got a call, and they said, "Would you come up and talk to us?" So I went up there, and they said, "Are you the gentleman that's on down at KSDA?" And I said, "Well, yeah, I've been on down there. We want you to come to work for us, and how much are you making?" And I told them, and they said, "Well, double if you'll come up here with us." And I said, "You just hired yourself a guy." So it didn't take me long to make up my mind.
I see. So you were, now, how old were you when that happened?
Well,
in your teen years, or?
I was got out of the Navy when I guess I was 20. I went in when I was 18.
Okay.
So I went to the Cambridge School of Radio Broadcasting in New York City. That was the number one school in the world. And I graduated at the top of the class there. And I was fortunate in doing that. And I went back and I went to my hometown, and they put me on the radio immediately there.
Mm-hmm.
And I was doing play-by-play sports. That's what I got into radio to do, was doing football, basketball, and baseball.
Sports announcing.
Yes, I was.
So how did you make the transition into country music?
Well, it wasn't always available. Play-by-play wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
I used to do play-by-play, excuse me, for other stations. As mm-hmm. a matter of fact, they'd call me and ask me if I would do certain games for them. And I would do that, and I was always happy to do those things. That was my first love.
Mm-hmm.
And I was fortunate enough that I was voted the best play-by-play guy in that area for a long time, and really enjoyed it. That was my, as I said, my first love.
Now, you actually started radio stations.
Yes, I did.
In your career.
Yes.
At 6, I believe you mentioned you started.
Yes, I did. I put a new station on in 1956, K-HEP, K-H-E-P. You ain't hip if you don't listen to K-HEP.
Okay. And where was K-HEP?
K-HEP, say.
But that was here in Phoenix?
No. That was in Texas. I mean, excuse me.
K-HEP was in
Phoenix.
You said 1956, right?
1956.
Yeah, because I think you came out here in 1951.
51, that's correct.
Okay, so that's the first station that you started on your own.
That was the first one I started, and it became a huge success because Elvis, the first record that Elvis Presley had was a 78, and he had Blue Moon of Kentucky and Milk Cow Blues Boogie, and he was on the Louisiana Hayride. Well, the rock stations wouldn't touch him with a 10-foot pole.
Mm-hmm.
And I told my staff, I said, I want at least 6 Elvis songs on every hour of the day at K-HEP. Every high schooler in the entire area was listening to our station. And a guy came in from another station. He had a Spanish-speaking station in John Redfield. And he came by one day, and he said, "You got to be walking about 10 feet off of the ground." I said, "What are you talking about?" He said, "The rating." I said, "What rating? I didn't know they had a rating." He said, "I've got a copy of it in my car, and I'll go out and I'll bring it in for you." So he brought it in, and my eyes popped way out to here. And I'm pointing to my hand now. And
you know how radio works.
This is radio. And I said, "Well, that's... I forgot where I was going now."
Well, you were talking about he brought in those charts, showed you your ratings.
He brought in the rating, and
you couldn't believe
the number one rated station for 7 years was KOY. They hadn't been beaten in 7 years. They had a 14, and my station had a 28.
And you were just on the air.
And we missed the first 2 weeks of the rating. We were only included in 2 weeks.
Wow.
And
you credit a lot of that to the fact that you were spinning Elvis and they wouldn't?
Exactly right, because every teenager in the whole valley was listening to my station. And then it was just sensational. The afternoon, the station that I had departed, and they went rock after, and took me out of my four-hour country station, was KRUX. And they were number two in the afternoon, and they had a 14, I had a 28.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Double the number two rated station.
That's
all
amazing.
Day long.
And that was with your first station.
That's correct.
So the other stations that you also started were in the Phoenix metro
K-Hat,
area, essentially.
K-Hat.
Okay.
Gordon McClendon, who started the Liberty Network. You remember the Liberty Network. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of sports and everything, and I did a lot of stuff for him. And one day he said, "That's the greatest call letters I ever heard for a country station, K-Hat."
That is. Now, did you always mingle sports broadcasting through your
not my station.
Broadcasting career?
No,
because
no.
When you're country,
you've got to do country and not have interruptions with sports and everything else.
Well, there's a few Elvis stories I want to make sure we cover. But before we go there, let's go back to sports again, because you did sports announcing in Phoenix as well. You got involved with the local fight market at what was called
Madison Square Garden
when it opened, which is interesting. They named it Madison Square Garden.
Yeah, New York.
Yeah, so you were doing some broadcasting of sporting events there.
I did wrestling, mm-hmm. and I did boxing on a radio, and so I covered all of it. And then I went to Tucson and did it down there with the same wrestlers and everything.
And was all that before there. You opened your first station? So that was all
no,
prior?
No. This was secondary.
Oh, okay. Well, that had to be kind of fun. See any great fights? Or was it mostly regional?
Yeah,
fights?
We had I had a heavyweight championship fight there, I had a middleweight championship fight there. Mm-hmm. Jimmy Martinez from Phoenix, and we had some good fights.
Mm-hmm.
The wrestling was good also. Packed crowds all the time for wrestling. Mm-hmm. I loved doing the ladies, and I loved the midgets.
Was it just more entertaining for you?
The little people.
Funner?
These little guys would grab each other and throw each other completely across the ring, you know, like that. And the crowds go crazy. And they love the women also.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
What was it like in terms of, I don't think they probably had a band playing at those events. They didn't incorporate music and entertainment like they do today with all this stuff, right?
No.
That'd been kind of interesting. Let's get now jumping around. I just keep jumping around back to the Elvis. I had heard a story I thought was pretty funny. You can tell me if it's true. That before you brought Elvis into town as a concert promoter the first time, he had contacted you. He was going through town, and he wanted to know if he could get on that.
Where'd you get that story from?
For gas money,
right? Yeah.
And you told him, no,
$30.
The show was booked.
$30.
You wanted $30 $30 going through town.
I should have put him on anyway. I could have found room for three songs.
But
anyway.
At that point, did you never heard of him yet, right? His first record wasn't out yet, or
no,
had you heard of him?
No, I knew of him.
He
had called me. He had called me and asked me if he could be on, see?
Uh-huh.
And he knew that I had a Saturday night stage show at Madison Square Garden there in Phoenix, and I did an hour stage show. And then we danced till 3 o'clock in the morning.
So,
So I said, Elvis, I've got, I'm booked solid for that hour. And I could have found room for two or three songs for him anyway.
Well, let me ask you if you remember, and I don't mean to tax your brain, and all
sure.
these dust some old stuff off here and read. But I feel like I'm just going through a little file card, picking things out. But how long was it between that event where you told him no to the first time you brought him into town?
It wasn't long.
Was
Mom.
Was it a year? Was it half a year?
I'm asking my wife.
A couple years?
Dolly.
No.
It was just a matter of a month probably, huh, babes? About a month before we brought him in then.
Was it 59?
Yeah. It was just a short time.
Okay. Well, I guess that doesn't even really matter to me. But the big thing that mattered to me was once he did come back, once you brought him in, did he remind you that you turned him down for that
$30
gig?
We didn't even discuss that.
But when you brought him back, I think I read as well that he was making about $10,000 for the next show because they had, all of a sudden the record's a hit.
It was
a bunch of money.
$10,000, that's what I paid him.
That's a lot of money for a show.
Oh, but it sold out. I mean, the people. I had him at the fairgrounds. Funny story.
Yeah.
I had him at the fairgrounds. Because we had no Coliseum in Phoenix at that time. They had one built shortly afterwards. And the tickets sold out in 30 minutes probably. And we had 10,000 people there.
Wow.
And interesting story. The next morning, the head groundskeeper came in and he said, "Boy, Ray, what a show with Elvis last night." He said, "That place was packed. You can believe the girls." My wife and I were sitting in the governor's box, and these girls, we were surrounded by girls, and not all bobby soxers. Some of these girls were 20, 22, 3, 4 mm-hmm. years old. And they were just grabbing their hair and just yanking on it like this. And some of them didn't get their hair. They grabbed their ears, and their ears turned red as a beet. And they were just so excited, you know, with Elvis being on the stage. The guy came in the next morning, and he said, "What a show." And I said, "Yeah, it was a dandy, all right." He said, "Well, we found something a little different when we went out there this morning, and we found over 60 pairs of girls' panties taken to the chain-link fence." True story.
Oh, my goodness.
True story.
You know, I can't imagine. That's today it seems it's a joke that, oh, you know, a woman's going to throw her panties on the stage. I've been in, you know, it shows for 30 years, 40 years ago in the clubs. I've never seen anybody throw any underwear at anyone, you know.
We have.
But
Dolly and I have.
It's
my
funny.
Wife and I
it's
have.
Funny that I also heard, was it a Beatles story or was it an Elvis story where the girls were having issues with all the urine running down by the front of the stage because girls.
I'll tell you about that if you'd like to hear it.
You know, honestly, I kind of do. I can't believe it. You know, let's hear it.
Okay, I was managing a road show, and we went all the way from Arizona to South Carolina, and I had a show there at this huge auditorium, and it was a giant, and it had a slanted floor from the back to the front. And from the first row of seats to the stage, it was about 20 feet there, mm-hmm. and they had carpet in there. And this manager was telling me, of the auditorium, said, "Yeah, we had Elvis in here," and he said, "My gosh, we couldn't get, we had 6,000 girls outside that couldn't get in." And finally, the fire marshal relented and let about half of those girls, so about 3,000 came in, and we put them underneath the balcony. And in England last year, remember, they had the balcony fell and hurt 70-some-odd people. Mm. So he finally relented and let them come in. Well, they still left about 3,000 outside, but they were just jammed in like sardines underneath there. And he said, "I went down after the show, and he said, I was sloshing around there in water." I said, "Holy smokes, I've got to get
a water line. Plumbing problem."
The water line broke here, and I've got to get that fixed. And he said, "Ray, these girls got so excited over listening to Elvis, they had peed, and it had run all the way down to the front of that stage, and I was sloshing around in pee, not water."
Well, and if they were packed in so tight, they didn't want to leave their space and
that's
find
right.
a bathroom, miss a song or two.
They
never get
lost.
Back.
That's
just,
right.
Who's going to know? I'll just go to the bathroom. That's crazy. That's just crazy. I mean, to have been him and to have incited that, and it has to happen every show he was playing at the
yeah,
time.
Yeah, of course
I mean, it,
it had
to be
did.
Crazy.
Sure, it did.
It's just nuts. What a crazy time. You brought Elvis to Phoenix a few times. I
yes,
guess, in
yes,
your
three
career.
Different times.
Okay. Anything stick out to in terms of the growth of those shows or what was changing?
No, they were just all
the
sold out. They were just sold out, you know, as soon as that they were available to get
yeah,
to,
I think,
to buy them.
I read either it was a comment you had made or someone made that when you booked Elvis, you didn't even have to promote it. It was sold out before you could
well,
even
absolutely.
Get around to it.
No,
once they knew he was coming, boom.
I didn't buy a dime in newspaper. I just, yeah. what my radio station, we just said, Elvis Presley is coming to town, you know, this
boom.
Big story, and that was it.
So do you remember when the bigger venues went in Phoenix for performance? Like, do you remember, like, what was the first big club after Madison Square Gardens that went and got it?
Riverside Ballroom.
Okay. Did you book shows down at the Riverside
Oh, yeah,
Ballroom?
Yeah.
Who'd you put in there?
Well, I couldn't, all of them.
All of
I couldn't
them? Everybody, get, everyone that made
I
a
I could
record,
only have know? Thursday night because he had, his dances, he'd have 1,000 people in there just for his dances. He had a big Western swing band, Bob Veit, who owned mm-hmm. Riverside Ballroom. Mm-hmm. And I had to have Thursday night to bring my talent in there. Mm-hmm. It was amazing.
So you brought a lot of people in earlier in their career, too. I think you brought Patsy Cline to town at one
oh,
point.
All
was
of
that
them.
The, was
all
that the
of
same
them.
Place?
All of them.
Well,
yeah.
when you say all of them, I'd kind of like to hear who some
okay.
of them were, if you recall some of those
well,
names.
Well, Johnny
back
Cash,
in the day.
I brought him there 20 times, probably.
Really?
Willie Nelson, probably 20 times. Patsy Cline, tell me, Mama. Johnny Western, yeah, we had all
yeah.
of these people there. Huh?
Freddie Hart.
Well,
sure.
Then for you, was it I mean, it had to be kind of interesting thing. You weren't a musician. You didn't start to play and write and play. You never kind of crossed that line.
No.
But in radio, you enjoyed music.
Yes.
We're a big fan. Obviously, you became aware of every record. And so then when you got in, I mean, the move into to promotion, how did that happen? Why did you start booking bands?
Just because it was the thing to do.
It was the thing to help the station,
the
radio station,
to promote it, you see.
Right.
So I just started booking talent. Like
essentially,
I said, Johnny Cash,
the
you know, we became real close friends as a result of that and brought in all of these artists. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I'd have three or four on the same show, little Jimmy Dickens and all of those. Little Jimmy one time, cute story. And he was clever one time, Marty Robbins. Marty, wasn't it, Mom? That said, Ray, please don't ever put me on behind Jimmy Dickens again. He said, that little rascal, he says he's got 101 liners that he throws out there. And he said, following him is like following a child act or an animal act. And he said, would you please ever put me on? It never happened that I had him on the same show after that. But I said, I promise you, I won't put you on. And Jimmy walked out there and he says, folks, he said, I'm feeling kind of down tonight. He says, we've been on the road, and he says, I'm tired. I probably haven't had enough sleep. He said, I'll tell you what, just going to bed at 3:45 and getting up at 3:45 just won't cut it. And that's one of those one-liners, see, that Marty was talking about.
That's funny.
And Marty said he's got 100 of those.
So how many concerts would you say you put on? Over
1,200.
1,200 shows?
At least 1,200, yeah.
And anything stick out as fun or something that you were most excited about when you brought him to town? Like, for example, you brought Frank Sinatra to town.
Brought Frank in.
That had to be pretty.
Talked with him for 3 hours.
Before you booked it, or at the night
dinner,
of the show?
We ate dinner before the show.
Oh, okay.
And he was a delightful person. He invited me to be a guest in his home. He said, you get over to L.A. or Hollywood? I said, yeah, we come over and I go call on advertising agencies for advertising for my station. He said, you have an invitation to be a guest in my home anytime you are over there. Lee Hazelwood, who wrote these boots, were made for walking. He and I disc jockeyed together. And I told him about it, and I said, he was just being kind. He says, baloney. He meant it, or he wouldn't have asked you to be there.
Wow.
This is cute. He said, you ought to see the sign over his doorbell. It says, you better have a damn good reason for ringing it.
That sounds like Frank.
Yeah.
You know, I read something he had said once. He was with friends coming out of dinner, and he tipped the you know, the door guy, Coke guy. He was going to tip him on the way out. So he asked him, hey, what's the biggest tip you've ever had, son? And the kid said, $50, Mr. Sinatra. And he says, okay, we gave him $100.
He would do that.
And then he said, by the way, who gave you that $50 tip? He says, you did, Mr. Sinatra.
I'll be darned.
So he's doubling his own tip just to make sure he was the biggest tipper in town. Yeah. But that was kind of funny.
He was great. We got to talking about his family when we were having dinner for 3 hours. And he was talking about his daughter, and he said, I went to this pastor to have my daughter baptized, and her name was Nancy. His wife's name was Nancy also. And he said, I asked the pastor, says, well, who are the godparents? And he said, Mr. and Mrs. Rosenblum, they can't be the godparents, they're Jews. And he said, I got so mad I couldn't see straight. And I said, do you want to baptize this baby or not? I'll go down the street and I'll get somebody. And he said, I had two $100 bills in an envelope in my pocket I was going to give to him. And he said, I turned around and took those out and I put two $1 bills in there. Sinatra said that. This idiot saying stuff like that.
Wow, that's pretty funny.
Yeah.
That had to be pretty cool. I mean, do you recall that dinner, sitting there for 3 hours with him? Do you recall that meeting?
Oh, yeah. We just had a lot of talk. And
that had to be exciting. I mean, it was Frank Sinatra.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that was like, gosh, today, I don't know if there's really a today type of a person who's in charge of the marketplace like that. Taylor Swift is the closest big name, I guess. But that had to be really, really special. And also, earlier, the first song we played was Ray Price.
Yeah.
Now, I believe that you had a relationship with Ray as well.
First show he ever worked in his life. He worked for me in Abilene. I brought him over from Fort Worth, and I paid him $75 cash. That's the first money he ever got paid for his show.
His first show?
Yeah.
Awesome.
That was his first show.
And was that after his first record was on the radio then? Or?
Had one record out. It was on the Bullet label. I don't remember the song, but mm-hmm. it wasn't a hit. But that was his first record.
Mm-hmm.
But he was a neat guy, and we became close friends. I trained racehorses for him also.
Oh, really?
He had a farm.
You trained racehorses?
We still train. We've trained for 61 years, my wife and I.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Awesome.
We trained in San Francisco.
Well, that's a whole other thing we'll talk about when we get a second, but let's keep going.
23 years in San Francisco we trained. We had some nice horses up there, and we get out some of the tapes and the horses wins, and shows their first 35,000 and 30,000 and about five times what they are at Turf Paradise in Phoenix. So
right.
We did well up there.
That's awesome. Now with Ray, you probably brought him in for shows over the years too, right?
Oh yeah, all the time.
Then you say you trained horses for him. So was he in the horse business for a long time?
He had a farm and he raised horses.
Okay.
So we trained three or four. We have tapes of his horses winning too, huh, Mama?
Now the tune, yeah. We've got, by the way, if you're not watching on TV, and which would be hard since we don't have any cameras up, the room is full of people that we're talking to on and off, and eventually we might turn on some other mics. But I still want to go back again before it turns into a complete, you know, full on party with everybody chatting. Let's get back to the Ray Price tune that was written by Chris Christopherson.
The one we played. One of the great writers of all time.
And while we were playing the record, you mentioned that. Oh yeah, I've got a story. Let's hear the Chris Christopherson story.
I don't have one.
Oh, didn't we have one? I thought. We don't have one. Okay. Oh, I'm wrong. I was confused. Sorry about that.
What a great songwriter, though.
Oh, isn't he?
The best.
Yeah, lots of great tunes. So, did you ever bring him in for a concert?
I did.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then let's see what else we got going here. Oh, back to the Elvis stories. Or actually, well, let me ask you, did you have a favorite Elvis song?
All of them.
Mm-hmm.
He was just awesome. My wife and I picked him up at the airport. She was 18. We weren't married. He was 19. And show you what a nice guy he was. And he and she were talking in the car. And I'm driving, and it was yes, ma'am, no, ma'am to her. And she's 18 years old. That's just how sweet a guy he was.
Yeah, he seemed like a gentleman. And how about Colonel Parker? Did you ever deal with him directly?
I did not. I did have to have 40 uniformed Phoenix policemen to surround the stage the night that I had him at the fairgrounds, because girls would storm the stage and try to rip his clothes. So that was in my contract with Parker.
Oh, wow. 40 back then. That 40. Seems like an awful lot.
He'd had that to happen numerous other events where the girls would storm the stage.
Jeez. The life of a rock star.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So also
country star.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. In fact, speaking of country stars, I saw something today, Kid Rock. I was doing something else while I was looking at this video on, I guess it was a YouTube feed through Facebook or something, where he's got this speech about running for Congress or maybe running for office as president. Was it a song? I don't know if it was a song or
it was
a speech, but Kid Rock.
Oh, okay.
And I thought, you know what? If we had a reality star become president, I bet Kid Rock's got like nothing between him and the presidency if he wants it. So that's going to be interesting next cycle.
Yeah.
But you also, you know, you brought in, being in Phoenix for so long, you brought in a lot of the local talent, brought them up as well as they were coming up. Guys like Al Casey, who was a big time.
Oh, you know, great, player. Great guitarist.
And there's a whole bunch of those guys. You mentioned Johnny Westrum. We've had Johnny on the show.
Yeah.
Another interesting character.
Yeah, you bet.
And then what I'd like to do, I'm going to bring on another guest to the show to talk with us after we play a song, a gentleman by the name of Jim West, who's been on the show before, who's also been big time character in the Phoenix Metro radio,
sure,
with a book called The Phoenix Sound. He's got a chapter on,
yeah,
on
you
your
bet.
Story in there as
sure.
well. So before we do, I thought maybe with all the talk on Elvis, we'd spin an Elvis track, give you a chance to take a drink of water. And this is one of, I think one of the songs that I really liked a lot when I was younger. And it's funny because I didn't really go so much for the fast rock and stuff.
Yeah.
But I kind of liked some of the pretty ballads. I just loved his voice. So here is Now or Never.
Yeah.
Remember that track?
Yeah.
And then we'll be right back on the Otto D Show with Ray Odom.
Great. Tomorrow
I saw you with your smile so tender. My heart was captured, my soul surrendered. I've spent a lifetime waiting for the right time. Now that you're near, the time is here. Just like a willow, we would cry an ocean if we lost true love and sweet devotion. Your lips excite me, let your arms invite me, for who knows when.
Listening to Otto D, coming at you live.
That was Now or Never from Elvis Presley. And before we bring Ray back on, I thought it might be time for a little bit of a movie update. The 5th Annual Jerome Indie Film Festival just happened this past weekend, and I'd like to congratulate Tony and Jason and all the volunteers for putting on an extremely successful event. There were a lot of cool films being played and a lot of cool people. It was a really, really good time. In fact, the first evening on Friday night, the lightning struck and the power went out in the whole city for a few hours, kind of shut things down till the morning. For a ghost town, that's kind of a fun story. And then I was lucky enough to have my first film actually accepted into the festival and shown, so that was a lot of fun. The Sweetheart Deal. To check it out and to stay on top of our production of the full-length version, you can go to faunafilms.com. That's faunafilms.com. And now we're back with Ray here on the show. Ray, thanks and welcome back again.
It's a delight to be with you, and you do a fantastic job.
Well, I appreciate that. You've been on the radio doing a fantastic job for years, and we have another friend of yours and a friend of mine, Jim West, with us today. Jim, how are you doing?
Hey, I'm good. Thank you, sir. Good to see you.
Another radio guy.
Okay. Yeah.
So now,
a few great ones there are of us left.
Hey, you know, yeah, absolutely. Now, I want to have Jim talk to you a little bit about some of the things that he's written in his book, The Phoenix Sound. And before we even get there, let's go back to your arrival in Phoenix in 51. I think I mentioned I came in 89. In 51, what was this place like? It must have been five separate towns, all these towns of Scottsdale and Mesa and Phoenix.
It was small. I went to work at KRIZ when I first went there as program and sports director. They had a thing called some kind of a line, and it went into stations all over the nation, and I was in Abilene, and I saw this, and they were looking for a program and sports director. Mm-hmm. And my first love was play-by-play sports. So I didn't even call them. I just drove out there.
Oh, wow.
And I had dinner with the owner of the station that night, Howard Loeb. And he said, I'll see you in the morning at the station. And I went to work that day.
Man, you know, you came up in radio, what I would consider to be radio's heyday.
It was good.
When it was the Wild Wild West. The industry was the Wild Wild West.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And I think that it was neat to think that stations had programs where the style of music changed. They'd have a rock show. It wasn't so much a rock station. Those things were still evolving before they became so prominent as identified as stations instead of programs these days. But anyway, let's bring Jim in. Jim's big time radio guy for years and years and years.
You bet. Thank you.
Give us a real quick overview of your career in radio in Phoenix for the listeners who may not know you.
I spent about 40 years in radio. I started when I was in the Air Force in South Dakota back in the 70s.
The Navy and the Air Force.
And Navy and Air Force guy here.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was 1973 is when I started in radio, and Ray already had 30 years on me. And then I spent about 40 years in country music and oldies radio, and I spent time here in Phoenix working for Buck Owens, KNIX, and all over the country. I mean, I programmed stations in Indiana, I programmed stations in Georgia, up in Colorado. I had a satellite network I programmed in Albuquerque. Wow. Places like that. Mm-hmm. So I did my rounds around the country and back.
And when did you first become aware of Ray?
I knew Ray Odom's name before I even met the man in the 1980s, because he was such a legendary figure in Phoenix radio and in the promotion and concert business that his name was bandied about all the time, way before I even met the gentleman. And then when I was working at KNIX, I think you were managing KJ at the time, weren't you not?
Yeah.
Yeah, in the late 70s, early 80s. Yeah, so I mean...
KJJJ.
Yeah, I was going to say, what a name.
Broadcasters at a luncheon one day, they said, Ray, you've always come up with the great call letters, K-HEP, K-HAT, K... And they said, K-HAY in El Paso, and K-BEAR in San Antonio... And then you come up with this station called KJJJ. And they said, then we tuned you in, and you had a two-letter call, the only station in the nation, K, letter K, K letter J.
Exactly.
So and that's why I went to KJJJ.
So actually, when I worked for Buck at KNIX, Buck Owens, we were competitors for a short time, you know.
Right.
But I always knew about Ray and his background, and then... When I started writing my book, I started doing some research, and, you know, the rest is history. I mean, the man was at Madison Square Garden in 1955 at the Arizona Hayride Show. He brought in people like Dwayne Eddy and Jimmy Dell, Al Casey, all the local people, Jimmy Spellman, all these local people that I wrote about in my book. He was the gentleman that promoted them first and launched their careers, especially people like Dwayne Eddy, people like that. Tell us about that.
Well, they were... and his buddy were in Coolidge, and that's about, 70 miles, I guess, to Phoenix. And they would hitchhike up, and I'd put them on my stage show at Madison Square Garden. And they really loved that, of course. And then I'd put them sometimes on my TV show also. I had a real popular TV show. And they were delighted to have that. So that's how that came about.
Everybody that I spoke with and that I went for my book research, talking about the people that you helped promote, they were so grateful because you gave them a chance to do what they wanted to do in life. Jimmy Dell, who is now a pastor, a preacher in the Nazarene Church, but back in the 50s, he was a rockabilly singer and on RCA Records, and Ray promoted him. And at the time, to be honest about it, and Jimmy will tell you the same thing, he grew up and had a stuttering problem.
Yes,
and he had a lot of confidence issues. And, you know, he was the first to tell us that Ray was, it didn't matter, you know, overcome it, you know, you're going to do great. And he was always encouraging to him, not just Jimmy Dell, but all the people that he brought in that were up-and-coming stars at Madison Square Garden. They were trying to get them together. And he was just, you know, helping these folks out and giving them a lot of confidence.
And then being on radio in the early years of rock and roll and country, where they were kind of rockabilly and mixing up, I imagine you met a lot of young artists, really, because they were being signed 18, 19, 20 years old and didn't really know anything about the world when they end up with a hit record or a
Tell us about the story of what you and Buddy Holly were touring for a short time.
Hey, this sounds good.
My partner, Bamford, called me one day and he says, Ray, you're going to go into Lubbock, Texas, and there's going to be a boy down there. And he says, you'll ride with him in his car, and he'll have the crickets with him. And he said, you'll be paying him $35 a day. And so that's how that started. And he just became a huge success.
And that was before buses, too, right? Everybody drove around their Cadillacs,
right? Yes, that's correct.
Now, was that $35 for Buddy and the crickets, or was that Buddy's money?
Probably gas money, I imagine.
Yeah, right? that's exactly what it was. It was for gas money.
For the car and for food. Just
yeah.
And you know what? Gas was like 15, 20 cents back then in those days?
Probably. Probably so.
Yeah, have a gallon, probably.
Wow. That's pretty incredible. So, Jim, how about some other things that you might recall from the book or from your research?
Doing research with Ray, like I said, he got involved with Madison Square Garden with the wrestling matches and all that kind of thing. He also promoted all the big events down there, all the country and rockabilly singers. He brought all these Grand Ole Opry folks in. Then you branched out and did the Riverside Ballroom.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he brought a ton of people in there. And Elvis, of course, we talked about that. Frank Sinatra came here in 57. Mm-hmm. And tell us about the story about Frank Sinatra, about the ball games and the sports scores.
Well, he came. I picked him up at the airport, and he had his manager and his bodyguard with him, and they were in the back seat. And I turned the radio off in the front, but I guess I left it on in the back, and there was a ball score. He said, "Ray, you know what the Red Sox did today?" I said, "Yeah, they won." Because I was a sports nut anyway. And he said, "You know what Ted Williams did?" I said, "Yeah, he hit two home runs and a triple, and he hit a home run in the ninth inning that won the ball game." I guess he just took a liking to me immediately because I knew scores, you know. So that's how that came about.
And you told me that the floor manager or the road manager came up to you and said, "What did you do to Sinatra?"
Yeah.
And the guy was just a jerk to
his
a lot
manager,
of people.
Yeah, he came up and he says, "Ray, what in the heck did you do to Sinatra?" I said, "He asked me a baseball score and what Ted Williams did." And he said, "He's been a real jerk on this entire tour, and you've got him eating right out of your hand."
Well, he must have been a sports nut. He had that in common. He had a respect for him for knowing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I had another question for you. I was unaware you had a television show. So tell me a little bit about that. What was that?
Well, we'd had it for a long time, and it was real popular. And if I had the guest stars in, like a Johnny Cash or Willie Nelson, and I'd have them to come down if the time was fitting.
And this was on an Arizona, essentially an Arizona broadcast.
Channel 3.
Channel 3, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I had a Friday night. That was on a Saturday, wasn't it, baby? And then on Friday night, I did a Friday night show, 30-minute show on Channel 10.
Okay.
That was Gene Autry's station. Gene and I became real good friends, and we were in the Country Music Association together.
Mm-hmm.
And he was president part of that time.
Right, yeah.
And we were the only two that dressed Western, and RCA, Capitol, and Delta.
Decca,
I mean.
All the great labels.
All of those. They had business suits on, and he and I were the only two. And so we just meshed every time there was a break, we'd get together, you know.
Yeah.
And one time he said, "How did you think the show went today so far, Ray?" And I said, "I thought it was good." He said, "Well, we discussed a long time about how much money we were going to spend to put a show to the New York Executives Club to try to get more country talent and commercials and in shows and so forth." And he said, "We were debating on how much we were going to spend." And he said, "At lunch today, I just spent $4 million on a business deal." I said, "Gene, that's your money." I said, "This is our association's money. We've got people from Africa, everywhere else, spending $10 a year to be members of the Country Music Association." I know.
And $4 million for Gene Autry was pocket change, right?
Yes, for sure. And it was. I told him one day, I said, that day, as a matter of fact, I think, I said, "Gene, I just saw on television yesterday that you're a billionaire." He said, "Oh, I don't know. I guess somewhere around there." He just threw his hand up like that. And I said, "Gene, you are a genius." I said, "You've got two hotels on Nob Hill, which is the most expensive area of San Francisco, and the Republican Party has conventions there whenever they have a convention in San Francisco." And I said, "Everything that you've touched has turned to gold." I said, "You've got ranches, you've got cattle on those ranches, and you've got all of these things." And he said, "Yeah, I have all of that." And I said, "Well, that's because you're a genius in whatever you do."
That's
definitely
pretty amazing.
Yeah.
So I didn't realize that Gene Autry owned a television station.
Yeah, he was part owner of Channel 10, KKOL, when it was Cool TV back in the day. Him and Tom Chauncey.
That's right.
Were the owners of Cool TV.
And he was a jilter.
And he had Channel 10 here and Channel 13 in Tucson.
Yeah.
You know, Gene Autry was part owner of Cool TV from the beginning back in the 50s.
Yes, he was.
Yeah.
Definitely so.
Yeah.
Now, you've been inducted into the Country Music Hall of Fame?
Yes.
And as a promoter or as a radio broadcaster, or what was the role that you were inducted as?
You were just recently inducted into the Arizona Music Entertainment Hall of Fame.
That's correct. Yeah.
Yes. Okay. Right here in Phoenix, in Arizona. So, and you've also been inducted into the Arizona Broadcasters Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you've got a ton of Hall
and
of Fames.
Fast Pitch Softball.
And the Fast Pitch Softball Hall of Fame.
Now, wait a minute. We haven't even gotten to raising the horses yet.
So yeah, we've got
to
get to
now
that.
We're going to get to baseball. So you were inducted to the Fast Pitch Softball Hall of Fame as a player or a pitcher or an umpire?
Dolly and I went to.
I
just have the thing here.
Awesome.
I got Jim Lewis' number down here. This was the Will Rogers Western Awards in Fort Worth, Texas, at Texas Christian University. And they gave me a Lifetime Achievement Award.
Okay.
There. So I had written it down here because I keep forgetting what the award was.
Will Rogers Western Awards, 21st annual. That's pretty awesome.
Yeah. They had about 10,000 people there that night, didn't they, Mama?
That's pretty cool. So, but I want to know more about this Fast Pitch Softball.
Tell us more about that, Ray.
We had some real good teams. And
sponsored by the stations in some sort of station league, or what was it?
We had a city league, and then we had a state league.
Okay.
And I had played fast pitch softball all my life, as a matter of fact. And we had a real top-notch pitcher, and his wife told us one day, we had a tournament up in Vegas, and she rode with us in the back. She said, Ray, she said, my husband had rather pitch to any player other than you. He said, you spoil more no-hitters off of him, and he just doesn't like to ever see you come to the plate. And I said, well, that's nice. And then he told me a few days later, he said, Ray, I hate pitching to you. In this one game shortly after that, it was nothing in the seventh inning. And we had two outs, and I hit a triple off of him in the left center field. And I saw the guy bobble the ball just briefly. And I wheeled around third base, and I said, I'm going to try to score. It's two out already.
Sure.
And I went head first, dived into the catcher. Safe. Game over. 1-0. Final score.
Wow.
And I got up, and I was fine. The next morning, I'd hurt my shoulder, and my wife had to brush my teeth and comb my hair. I couldn't get my arm up.
Wow.
Oh, wow.
And I tore the bursa sacs in my right
shoulder. I have one question. For all the things you've done, it's been radio, television show, concert promotion. We're going to talk about racehorses coming up here in just a bit. And where did you ever find time to sleep? Did you ever sleep
oh,
in
no,
50,
he didn't. No,
50
he,
years?
No, he didn't sleep. I mean, you don't have time for everything.
You have to ask my wife. She knows more about that than I do.
Anyway.
Sounds like maybe she did all the driving so you could sleep. You're still driving. You're still driving all over town yourself, right? You're still driving around.
This gentleman is 91 years young.
Yeah.
And still driving everywhere, doing great.
Bev Cole is with us, and Bev's mentioned to me, I'm just going to make a look. I know she's all embarrassed from me even saying her name. But she mentioned to me, you know, he's driving still. And when I'm with him and he's driving, I feel the safest when anybody else is driving. It's great. So I thought that was quite a compliment.
Yeah.
Because I know, you know, for a lot of people, it's kind of like, okay, that's enough, Dad. Let's take that car keys away.
Yeah.
And I went through that with my father-in-law when I was married. He just got to the point where, you know, maybe you shouldn't be driving, Dad. And what's he do? He takes a puppy, because he loves the puppy, because he moved in with us. He takes the puppy on his lap to the store.
Right?
And of course, then the dog jumps up in your lap, and they're Italian greyhounds. These are hyper little animals.
Yeah.
And he drives under the median and hits an Ocotillo, which is, for those of you who don't live out here, it's a spiny little, spiky little cactus tree thing. You know, puts a hole in his tire, comes back, parks the truck, and says, had a little accident.
So greyhound.
Like, Dad, come on.
Greyhound dog.
So glad to hear you're doing so well with that. But listen, before we go, actually, we got about 10 minutes, but there's something else we haven't touched on, and that is that Ray is writing a book.
Yes, indeed.
Tell me about this. What's the book all about?
Tell us about the book, Ray, or would
you
like me to help?
I'd rather you
tell
me about the book.
Jim, tell me about Ray's book.
I do.
Well, since Jim's an author, and I'll show all the viewing people watching us on
exactly,
TV the cover
of
the book.
We're holding up the book right now.
Yeah, there you
anyway,
go.
Bev Cole and I have been working with Mr. Odom here to get his memoirs together with all the 65 years in show business, basically, and we're interviewing a lot of people. We've talked to Golly, a lot of celebrities. We're still working on more, as a matter of fact. We're trying to get a hold of Willie Nelson, and I'm working on that. I'm trying to get a hold of, well, Loretta Lynn has been ill lately with a...
Really?
Yeah, she had a stroke here not long ago. You brought Loretta Lynn. You're one of the first to bring Loretta into the valley back in the day. And not only that, we're just helping him with his memoir, getting his book going. So,
cute story about Loretta Lynn, if you don't mind me interrupting.
Please.
Loretta one day said... she did this all the time. She'd say, "Folks, I want you to look at Ray Odom here." She said, "Look how he's dressed." She said, "Look at this. He's got a cowboy hat on, and this is before 1,000 people there." And she said, "Look at this shirt." She said, "His wife makes these frills and puts him on his shirt," and said, "But last," and said, "he has his suits tailor-made all the time," and said, "Look at his boots. Now, these are not patent leather. They look like patent leather, but it's called patina, which is a lot stronger than patent leather.
Mm-hmm.
But now look at on the toe of that boot. That's sterling silver on the toe of his boots." She said, "He's got," but said, "I got to tell you this. He wears the raggediest underwear of anybody you have ever seen."
And what's the punchline?
My punchline was, "Loretta, I want to know what you and I were doing that you saw my underwear."
She probably turned beet red.
She did.
That is funny. So, gosh, Loretta Lynn, there's so many people.
Yeah.
It just keeps, all these names keep popping up. And I'm thinking, I'm in the same room with the guy who brought these people to Phoenix the first time when they were just
starting out. A lot of them were just starting out, you know. And this gentleman, you know, is helped.
They could go to a station and cater to the station to do what, you know, "Here's my record. Please play. What can I do for you?"
But he was one of the pioneers to help promote these people and to launch their career, like Dwayne Eddy and Al Casey and some of the great Phoenix people and the Phoenix players here.
Cute story about Dolly Parton. I had her at...
What is it with you keep telling us stories? We're talking right now, guys.
Dolly Parton, I brought her for a show in Phoenix, and we had KJ, which was at the former TV station.
Right.
And so we built that studio, and so she was over there, and I said, "I didn't know you did come back to the station, Dolly." And she said, "Yeah, sure." I said, "I've got to go to Applebee's down here and meet a bunch of radio people and some TV people." And she said, "Can I go with you?" And I said, "I'd love to have you go, but I didn't know you'd want to go." And she said, "I'd love to." So we got out of the car, opened the door for her, and she grabbed my hand, and she didn't turn it loose for the whole hour that we were in
there. You're walking in the restaurant with Dolly Parton.
Yeah. So I was a star, too, see, bringing Dolly in. And everybody just swarmed to her, you know.
Of course.
And she was always asking them instead of those people wanting to ask her things. And she'd say, "Well, what do you do at the TV station? Well, what do you do at the radio station?" She wanted to know about them, you know.
You know, she strikes me that way because she was a smart woman,
businesswoman
what she did. And you don't get that when you're not a questioning personality.
That's right,
sure.
And so she walk in a room, she wants to work it. Who do I want to make sure I know before I leave?
Exactly.
You know, so.
She's a delightful, delightful lady.
We didn't even talk about the racehorse industry.
Racehorse industry. My wife and I have been training racehorses 61
when
years.
When did you start doing that?
I was going to say, are you still?
61 years ago.
Yeah,
61
years ago.
That's when we started.
Okay.
And my wife was in it before we were married because her dad had quarter horses, and we trained thoroughbreds. And we've had a lot of great fun and a lot of success. As I said, we trained in San Francisco 23 years. We had some nice horses up there, and the purse structure was excellent there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so we did quite well financially up there.
Not only that, you also were the first to broadcast horse racing at Turf Paradise in 1963.
We did that, and thank you, Bev.
Yeah.
And they put up a booth there. Walter Kluwer, who built Turf Paradise and was the owner of Turf Paradise, he and I were real close friends. One day he said, "Ray, our Breeders Association here, they've got 9 members." And he says, "I want you to become president And I said, "God, I've got to run this radio station to run, Walter." And
he never slept. Remember, we were talking about that. He never slept.
And he said, "I said I'll do it if you hire Pat Thompson to be the secretary." And he said, "You got a deal." So I don't know if he paid her or what, but this, she was awesome. She was a bloodline expert, and she was she was just terrific. And it wasn't what, Mom. A few months later, we had over 100 members, from 9 to over 100, just in that short
So you helped promote and grow the Turf Paradise Club here in Phoenix. Yeah.
Yeah.
Been around forever.
Yeah. So anyway, it was, that's just part of the background.
And you raced up in San Francisco and other tracks.
23 years we raced there, and they met us in Golden Gate, and we raced on all the fair circuits, which we loved that. And
you're still doing it. I mean, you've got horses now.
Yeah, we still have horses, and we'll be going.
How many do you have?
Five.
Five horses.
Yeah. But we'll
be. How long do you think you're going to do it?
Forever.
Forever?
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah, we don't want to ever stop. Hey, Mama.
Keeps them young, I think.
Yeah. It does.
Something does.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking about getting into the horse business.
My doctor told me one day, he said, "Ray, I'm going to make a prediction now that you're going to live to be 110 years old." I said, "Why do you say that?" He said, "Well, I know the longevity of your family. The Odom family goes back a million years." And he said, "I know the longevity in your family." He said, "I know that you had two great-great-grandfathers that fought in the Civil War, one for the North and one the South, and they both got killed. And then my daughter bought me a book, and it had 40 Odoms that fought in the Civil War."
Wow.
"And those who survived lived to be in their 80s back then in 1865.
Wow.
And the lifespan at that time was 60s. Yes. So he knew about that, my doctor did.
Wow.
And he said, "I know you train racehorses, and you go out to track 6 o'clock every morning and train those horses. You walk with them. You do all of these things. That keeps you active. You're busy all the time.
You're in there mucking out the stuff, you know?"
No, we don't do that.
Oh,
We've got
that?
A groom that does that. Okay. Anyway, he said, I just
think
really
that you'll like
live
an underachiever
to be
here.
I said, "Well, if I'm of sound mind and body, I want to be here.
Yeah.
Otherwise, get me the heck out of this place."
Yeah.
So that's.
So, but it's a passion of yours, though, right now. I mean, radio and concerts
we
were a passion
it.
For years.
We love it.
Now it's a passion.
So, naming horses.
And my wife, I trained some horses at one time in San Francisco for a while, and she trained a bunch in Phoenix. And she was winning more races than I was. She's a terrific trainer.
That's awesome. It's great. It's great when the competition's in the family. Someone's going to win. You know?
Yeah.
Well, what else is in the future for you? So you got a big race coming up?
Well, Turf Paradise season opens pretty soon, right?
Yeah. We take the horses in Friday.
Oh, okay, good.
And then we start training for about a month, and then the meet opens in October.
And we're hoping to have Mr. Odom's book out here by the first of the year.
Cool.
To have that published and ready to go. And then we're going to be doing a lot of book signings.
Out there,
as a matter of fact.
Book signings at the Turf Paradise.
At the Turf Paradise,
awesome.
among other places. Yeah.
What's the name of one of your horses that's going to be running first? Do you remember? Which one are you most excited about?
Drafty Breeze. She's probably the best of the lot. Dolly's
Drafty
Party
Breeze,
Doll.
I love that.
We named one after Dolly. Dolly's Party Doll is another one. Who else?
Isn't that fun coming up with the names?
Ursula.
You guys enjoy that?
Yeah.
We have one named Ursula.
Ursula?
Ursula's Night Watch, yeah.
Okay.
Ursula's Night Watch. So just what day do I need to be out there, and what horse do I need to put my money on? That's
exactly.
We don't even bet. We had a close friend who had horses with us for a long time, Alan Goodman. He's long since gone. He lost $4 million betting on horses.
Wow. That's a lot of money to lose.
He had it to lose, but
that's good.
His wife didn't know he was betting like that.
Don't
say that, Mama.
I understand.
Okay, it's going all over the world. I know that.
Yeah. Well, and you know what? It's going to go all over the world forever because it's going to be posted 24/7.
A renaissance man in media.
Yeah. You had mentioned in your book, he's a jack of all trades and master of many.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
You know. Well, listen, Ray, we're coming up on the end of the hour, so I just want to thank you for coming in and sharing some of these stories.
I know you're a great host.
Well, thank you.
And you should do this for the rest of your life.
Well, hopefully I will.
Yeah.
It's a lot of fun.
You
and
bet.
I enjoy it.
You bet.
All right. Well, thanks a lot. And you know what? I'm going to have to get down to Turf Paradise and see the horses. When I do, I'll
do
look you up if you don't.
Sure. Do that, please.
All right. Take care. And thanks, Jim, for coming in, too.
Hey, thank you very much.
Take care.